She was so genuine and down to earth.
Always funny, always tried to turn a situation around, making you laugh all the time. She once said to us, I could never have a birthday party because not enough people had come. And then when we was at the funeral, you know, there was just so many people that loved
people
Joanne.
Couldn't even get in the room, could they?
You know, nobody could fit in. And it's just, that just, what does that tell you? You know, Joanne was a brilliant person and everybody loved her. Very family orientated, definitely.
Hi M&Ms, welcome back to another episode of Murder & More. As always, I am your host, Kira. Valentine's Day is a day full of love and appreciation for your partner or spouse. It's supposed to be a day where you celebrate the person you are sharing your life with and have the opportunity to reflect on how far you've come and discuss your future together. Unfortunately, for Joanne Nelson, Valentine's Day in 2005 would not be full of red roses, soppy cards and boxes of chocolates. Instead, Joanne's Valentine's Day ended in a way that no one could have ever imagined. Joanne Nelson was her family's darling, the most popular girl among her group of friends, who was described as a bubbly, bright and loving young woman who had everything to live for. Her mother described her as a loving, kind, considerate girl who would never do anything to upset her family. Joanne had a knack for touching the hearts of everyone she met, with her sister Katie later describing her as a wonderful person who always looked out for her little sister. Katie says Joanne taught her right from wrong. She recalls Joanne as just being a really good person who was high on life and fun-loving. Joanne loved sports and she was very talented at them too. She particularly enjoyed playing netball and rounders and loved to swim. Joanne had spent some time training to be a nurse, however quit as she found it too emotional, constantly coming home crying over sick patients she'd encountered. Trust me when I say I know exactly how she felt. I can't begin to tell you the amount of times I've come home crying over my patients. Joanne had been accepted to work with Voluntary Services Overseas, a volunteer, non-profit organisation designed to help fight poverty. There are several different places Voluntary Service Overseas visits and supports, including Ghana, where Joanne had been accepted to go, Pakistan, Nigeria, Thailand and the Philippines, just to name a few. They have several different aims: to ensure everyone has access to education and is able to learn the skills they require to live a fulfilled life, to improve healthcare and ensure everyone has access to it, and to ensure everyone possesses the skills and opportunities to live a secure life. Joanne loved her family to bits, but she longed for one of her own one day, and she thought she may have found the man she could start a family with in Paul Dyson. Paul was born in August 1974 to Christine and Peter Dyson. He grew up in Hull with his parents, sister and half-brother. As far as anyone could tell, there was nothing in his childhood to indicate that Paul would grow up to be anything but a kind, loving, normal man. However, despite the lack of warning signs, this was not how Paul Dyson turned out. While Paul showed no signs of violence in his earlier years, the same couldn't be said for his father Peter. In 1967, when Peter was just 22 years old, he stabbed a man with a kitchen knife over a friendship he had with Peter's wife. He was convicted of manslaughter and sentenced to 6 years in jail. I can't find a date as to when, but in another incident, Peter Dyson killed 47-year-old Gordon Kell in a road traffic accident, but somehow managed to avoid prosecution. When Paul was 16, he left school and attended Hull College, gaining a diploma in civil engineering, and later went on to get a diploma in National Horticulture at Bishop Burton Agricultural College. He spent a few months in Saudi Arabia with his father when he was 17, working in general maintenance, and would later go on to spend some time being a gardener before working as a machinist at M&K Pine, a furniture shop in Hull. When Paul was at Bishop Burton College, he met Kerry Thompson, who would later go on to tell police that he would pace up and down, hitting walls and grabbing her to stop her leaving when they had arguments. They eventually split up, and 6 years later, in 1999, Paul met Jenny Marie Clark. Paul proposed to Jenny just 2 weeks after they met, and they had a daughter, Chloe, together in October 2000. Paul and Jenny split up in 2002 and filed for divorce later that year, after the blazing rows they would have in public became too much. Shortly after Paul separated from Jenny, he met Joanne Nelson in 2003. Joanne met Paul on a night out in Hull at the Mint Bar and Club, where the bodybuilder worked as a doorman. When he was 15, Peter introduced his son to kickboxing. Colin Allen trained Paul, and in 1995 he became a reserve for the British team in the World Kickboxing Championships. Not long after that, Paul became equally as obsessed with bodybuilding and went on to use anabolic steroids. Anabolic steroids are a synthetic variation to the male hormone testosterone, a hormone that's produced by the testicles, which plays a huge role in sperm production and also affects bone and muscle mass. Testosterone isn't just found in men, a woman's ovaries also produces it, but a woman will have a much lower level of it than a male will. When combined with estrogen, low levels of testosterone helps with the growth and development of a woman's reproductive tissues and bone mass. Too much testosterone in a woman can change their appearance, causing excessive growth of hair, deepening of the voice, and increased muscle mass, along with irregular menstrual cycles, a low libido, and mood swings. Anabolic steroids are used, or rather misused, as a performance-enhancing drug, as they increase muscle mass and decrease fat. Anabolic steroids are a Class C drug and can only be sold by a pharmacist, and most organisations involved in professional sports ban the use of them. Side effects of anabolic steroids in men include a reduced sperm count, infertility, erectile dysfunction, shrunken testicles, breast development, and an increased risk of prostate cancer. In women, the side effects are excessive facial and body hair, a deepened voice, problems with periods, and an increase in libido. Besides these side effects, there's also an increased risk of having a heart attack, stroke, or liver or kidney problems or failure that comes alongside anabolic steroid use. Misuse of anabolic steroids can also cause serious psychological side effects, including aggression, paranoia, and mood swings. When Paul and Joanne met, he was 27 and she was just 19. They dated for a while and ended up moving in with each other, with Joanne completely unaware of his violence towards his ex-wife, his anabolic steroid misuse, and his father's violent past. Peter Dyson had actually passed away 3 years before they met in 2000, which absolutely devastated Paul, as he idolised his father despite his past. Joanne had it all, a loving family, a great group of friends, and the perfect boyfriend whom she idolised and couldn't wait to marry, or so she thought. All of that changed on the 14th of February 2005, 2 years after the couple met, when Joanne failed to show up for work. Paul reported her missing to police at 9 p.m. that evening, claiming they'd exchanged Valentine's cards and he'd left for work whilst she was still in bed.
Hello there. My fiance, I don't know where she is. I just want to report somebody missing.
What's her name, please?
It's John Nelson. John Jean Nelson. I'm assuming she's been to work and that, but it's just that the car's parked further up the road and the doors are unlocked. I've been trying to get hold of her on the phone since I've got in. There's no answer. Nobody seems to know I had no air of her.
So it was parked further up the street and all the doors are unlocked?
Yeah.
Do you know the reg?
Does anybody know the registration?
Who's out there with you?
Her mum and dad.
Right. Has there been any arguments or anything, or should you threaten?
No, nothing like that. I mean, it's just completely out of character for me.
A few days later, when Joanne failed to show up at the funeral of her best friend's father and failed to call her sister Katie on her 19th birthday, the people closest to Joanne became increasingly concerned for her safety. Paul Dyson acted like a loving, grieving boyfriend. On the 16th of February, 2 days after he reported Joanne missing to police, Paul gave an emotional television appeal where he broke down, clutching a handkerchief, begging for his girlfriend's safe return. He described the deep bond of love he shared with Joanne and told reporters that he loved her to bits and would never do anything to hurt her.
Monday morning, because I couldn't get Valentine's Day off, we swapped cards upstairs. I gave her a kiss and a cuddle, got ready for work. And she was going to get her head down for another hour or so.
What does Joanne mean to you?
She's the only person I truly love. I want to know where she is. I want her back.
The following day, Joanne's devastated parents, Jean and Charlie, gave a heartfelt and emotional appeal for any information relating to Joanne's disappearance at a press conference in Hull.
She's very close to all our family and she wouldn't do anything to upset us. Her disappearance is very out of character. She's idolised by Paul, her fiancé, and is looking forward to getting married next year. Please just let her know or just contact us. We're not cross with her at all. We just want to...
Paul was arrested in relation to her disappearance shortly after Joanne went missing on the 18th of February. And just 3 days later, despite no body being found, Paul was charged with her murder. Paul remained adamant that he hadn't murdered Joanne, that she must still be alive. But police weren't buying his story. They used forensic analysis to analyse their interview with him, and this was how they came to the conclusion that he had murdered Joanne. Paul was very clearly trying to squeeze out tears to portray the grieving, concerned boyfriend, but the analysis revealed something much more telling. Former Detective Superintendent Ray Higgins spoke of the moment he knew he was interviewing Joanne's killer. Quote, Dyson's television interview was very similar in many respects to the one he gave me. He stuck to the same story. Although he was very distressed and very tearful, he was also very deliberate in what he said. In the interview, there was two marks on his thumbs. I knew from dealing with previous assaults and murders that involved strangulation, the first thing a victim will try and do is pull those hands away from their neck. Sometimes in doing so, they can leave sort of crescent-shaped fingernails in the skin of the offender, and certainly in this case, the news crew zoomed in on Dyson's hands. You could quite clearly see what appeared to me to be similar crescent-shaped marks on the back of his thumbs. End quote. A huge manhunt ensued, with more than 60 police officers and special constables, army volunteers, divers, and search and rescue teams searching hundreds of miles of countryside across Yorkshire. On the 17th of March, a black handbag was found on a railway line just under a mile from where Joanne and Paul lived at Hotham Road North, which police believed belonged to Joanne. Even though, by this point, police were sure Paul had murdered Joanne, even they weren't prepared for the shocking twist they were about to face. In a hugely brave act, Paul's mother came forward to tell police that she knew for definite that her son had killed Joanne. When asked how she came across this information, she revealed that Paul had told a good friend in confidence that he strangled Joanne, and rightly so, this friend went straight to Paul's mum. When confronted with this information, Paul admitted that he'd lied and confessed to killing Joanne, but claimed he couldn't remember where he'd left her body. The only thing he could remember from the area he dumped Joanne's body was a metal gate, possibly with blue bottles next to it. The search for Joanne was the largest search Humberside Police have ever undertaken, which was hampered slightly by bad weather. The police spent hours upon hours driving Paul around North and East Yorkshire to try and see if he could remember the gate. In despair and desperate to find Joanne's remains, police brought in forensic ecologist Professor Patricia Wiltshire, who has been described as a, quote, super sleuth who tunes into nature to catch criminals, end quote. Patricia told Country File how she helped police find Joanne's body. Quote, her boyfriend eventually admitted that he'd killed her, but he couldn't remember where he'd put her. When I got access to his car, footwear and garden fork, I was able to predict and describe the place, and I said she won't be buried, she'll be in a hollow covered in birch twigs, end quote. Using this information, police were able to narrow down the places where Joanne's body could be. They knew what type of soil they were looking for, and they knew that they were looking for an area where western hemlock and birch trees grew together. Police used botanical maps in order to identify which places fit the description, which led them in the direction of Castle Howard and North York. Detective Superintendent Ray Higgins, who was head of the investigation, was out looking for the next place that they could search to locate Joanne with Detective Constable Phil Gadd on the afternoon of the 24th of March 2005. It was whilst they were out searching for their next search location that they came upon a gate that matched the description Paul had given them. Ray recalls finding this gate. Quote, we had a steel gate which opens outwards. It is supported by two wooden posts and it had rabbit netting to each side, exactly as Dyson had described to us. End quote. The detectives knew they needed to investigate what lay beyond the gate, knowing that Paul could recall that he'd left Joanne about 30 yards from the gate. But when they reached 30 yards and there was no sign of Joanne's body, their hopes diminished. That was until they came to a large dip. Ray Higgins recalls this moment. Quote, the first thing I saw was the shape of a bin bag. Looking at it more closely, you could see the bin bags had been wrapped with clear tape. I realised then and there that in reality, the search was over, and we had found Joanne, end quote. As the body found wrapped in the black bin bags had been out in nature for almost 6 weeks, it was badly decomposed and it was impossible to determine straight away if the body was that of Joanne's. The post-mortem was performed the following day, which confirmed that the search for Joanne Nelson had ended, and it also determined that Paul had indeed strangled his girlfriend to death. In response to the finding of Joanne's body being found, Professor Patricia Wiltshire said, quote, when they found her, she was just off the road in a hollow covered with birch twigs. It doesn't matter where we go in nature, we always leave a trail behind us, and I used these clues to pinpoint police in the right direction, end quote. So what happened on that fateful night, on the 14th of February 2005? The 14th of February 2005 should have been just like everyone else's Valentine's Day. It should have been full of love, happiness, and appreciation of each other. But for Joanne Nelson, this Valentine's Day would be like no other, and it would be her last. It's believed that tensions began to rise in the months leading up to Joanne's murder, mainly around Paul's laziness around the house. But they also had frequent arguments over something larger than that, their careers. Whilst Joanne was progressing in her career and talking about travelling the world one day, Paul struggled to hold down any jobs that he had, which all paid a very low wage. Not only did he have himself to support, but he also had his daughter Chloe to support financially too. It's believed that on Valentine's Day 2005, Joanne challenged Paul about his inability to turn on a washing machine, which is just absolutely baffling to me that a man in his late 20s has no idea how to use a washing machine. He clearly never had to lift a finger around the house, or felt like he never needed to at least, and I can imagine Joanne was completely fed up of doing all the work to keep everything running smoothly. During this confrontation, Paul lost his temper and burst into a fit of rage, with an argument quickly ensuing where the couple talked about breaking up and even selling the house. At some point during that argument, Paul strangled Joanne to death. Having just murdered his girlfriend of 2 years, Paul Dyson walked to the corner shop near their house, leaving her dead in their home, where CCTV shows him calmly buying bin bags, rubber gloves and disinfectant spray, obviously to dispose of her body and erase any evidence he may have left of her murder. He then drove to his mother's house to borrow a garden fork in order to bury her. When he got home, Paul calmly had a conversation with one of his neighbours, asking if she'd had a good holiday and telling her that Joanne was good and they were planning on getting a cat together. Mr. Worsley, the prosecutor, told the court, quote, he appeared his usual self. Back inside his house, he used string to tie together the hands and feet of the lifeless Joanne. He then bundled her body into bin liners and secured them with tape, end quote. Paul then put Joanne's body in the boot of her car in broad daylight, went and got some petrol, and then made the 75-mile journey to Joanne's temporary resting place. He carried her body about 250 yards beyond the gate in the middle of the countryside and placed her in a concealed dip amongst the pine trees, where she lay, undisturbed, unnoticed, missed for 40 days before it was found by Detective Superintendent Ray Higgins. After leaving Joanne's body, Paul then returned back to the home they shared and began his cover-up. He got rid of her work clothes and left messages on her phone to indicate that he had no idea where she was. He then left for work and staged a mock conversation over the phone with Joanne in front of his friend to make it look like she was still alive. But in reality, Joanne was lying in a hollow pit, having been strangled by the man she trusted and loved. Joanne's funeral took place in May that year, where 200 mourners attended to say their final goodbyes to the fun-loving, family-orientated girl. Joanne's family will never get over the loss of their daughter and sister, with her sister Katie giving a moving tribute at her funeral. Quote, anyone who knew Joanne knew she was a wonderful person. She was fun-loving, high on life, and bubbly. She was always the good one, so it's hard to understand why something like this would happen to her. She was my big sister, always looking out for me and taught me what was right from wrong. I didn't always take notice of her, but she was always right. I miss you so much. I wish I could give you one last kiss, one last hug, but I'll be kissing you and hugging you forever. End quote. In one hearing, Paul admitted to the manslaughter of Joanne, but on the 5th of November 2005, he changed his plea and admitted to Joanne's murder. The hearing at Hull Crown Court lasted only 3 minutes, with Paul Dyson only talking to confirm his name and enter his plea of guilty, with Joanne's family watching on in the public gallery. Paul Dyson was sentenced to life in prison, with Judge Tom Cracknell describing Joanne's as a, quote, unspeakable evil deed, end quote. Paul should have served 16 years before being eligible for parole. However, just last year, in October 2019, Joanne's family were forced to face the nightmare they went through 14 years earlier, when it was revealed that Paul had been moved to an open prison. Joanne's sister, Katie, recalls the heartbreaking moment they heard the news. Quote, we were told by victim support he was up for parole for open prison, and then told us they decided yesterday that he would be released to one for the remaining 2 years of his sentence. It is heartbreaking. It's no time at all. To hear it was just sickening and unbelievable. I can't make sense of it. It's a massive shock and seems really unfair. Katie went on to say that her and her family have been living a nightmare that started the day Joanne disappeared and has never ended. The nightmare just escalated when the family were asked to send a statement to the parole board, who were considering moving Paul to an open prison. Quote, we had to send in a victim statement. My mum couldn't be involved in it because we had to dredge everything up and send it over, and it has clearly had no impact. It has been a nightmare and has not been out of our minds since the day she went missing. It was a good 6 weeks before they found Joe, with no help from him, and it brings it all back. For my parents, I'm a mum myself now. I can imagine how they feel, and as a sister, the pain is excruciating. End quote. She says that if Joanne knew about how much Paul idolised his father, despite being a killer himself, and Paul's previous convictions, she knows Joanne would have left him. Quote, he idolised his father, who stabbed a love rival who he thought was sleeping with his wife. He also killed a guy in a hit and run, and I know as a person she wouldn't have been able to accept that as a partner. I don't think any of this has been taken into consideration when looking at his parole. We want to raise awareness and try to help others too. We want his face back in the public domain to remind people what he has done. Joanne isn't getting to live the life she was owed, and he could do it again. The thought of him being sat in his cell, thinking he is going to start his life now. We want to let people aware he is out walking the streets again. End quote. It's heartbreaking to me that Paul Dyson, now 45 years old, could be out walking the streets within the next few years. He has plenty of years left to live, years that Joanne should have lived, years where Joanne could have been happy, had kids, got married. But instead, Paul Dyson ripped that opportunity from her, and no amount of years he's served will ever take the pain from Joanne's family. Paul is also accused of attacking his ex-wife. This wasn't just a one-off event. I believe that when Paul is released, he will still pose a threat to people he comes into contact with. I really don't believe that anyone is or ever will be safe around Paul Dyson, and I just hope and pray that he doesn't get the opportunity to cut anyone else's life short. Joanne's family will never get over her tragic loss, a life full of love, happiness, and positivity that was cut short way too early, in the most horrific way. Thank you for listening. Don't forget to head over to Apple Podcasts to leave a rating and review, and Patreon to consider becoming a patron of Murder & More. To interact with us, you can follow us on Twitter and Tumblr at Murder & More, Instagram at Murder & More Pod, and Facebook at Murder & More Podcast. To view the sources and pictures for this episode, head over to www.murderandmorepodcast.wordpress.com. Have a great week, and I'll see you all next week for another episode.